I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Although they never met, George Orwell and Winston Churchill had a lot in common besides their British heritage. They both had uncaring fathers. They were journalists who fought in wars. They were fiercely opposed to totalitarianism, whether of the left or of the right. They cared deeply about language and stood up for their beliefs no matter how popular. That's what our guest Tom Ricks writes about in his new book, Churchill and Orwell, The Fight for Freedom. He also writes at the end of the book that these two men have much to offer us about the importance of principles and facts. Tom Ricks covered the U.S. military for many years for The Wall Street Journal and for The Washington Post, including operations in Somalia, Haiti, Bosnia, Afghanistan, and Iraq. His other books include The Generals, Making the Corps, and Fiasco, about the early days of the Iraq War that was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. He's an advisor on national security at New America Think Tank. He's a contributing editor to Foreign Policy magazine, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Tom Ricks, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
So why are these two men such heroes for you?
Well, first, I'm a journalist, or used to be a journalist, and I consider myself just a plain writer. They were always heroes to me, but a few years ago, I was actually sitting down and looking at 20th century journalism and trying to figure out why some didn't seem to work nowadays and some did. I started with H.L. Mencken. It just seemed totally anachronistic, out of date. Moved on to E.B. White, good prose stylist, but didn't speak to my concerns. S.J. Perlman, not funny. Hemingway, blowhard.
Oh, ouch.
And then I picked up Orwell, and it was such a revelation. His words were so fresh. His interests and concerns and observations seemed like they came from today. And of these all, he was the only one who you could take a passage from, put it in today's newspaper, and it would fit right in. And so that intrigued me. And then I realized that there's kind of a parallel with Churchill, a very different person in so many different ways, yet who also kind of even speaks to our own time in a way that other people from 80, 90, 100 years ago don't.
Well, you describe so many chapters and parts of their life, but one in the 1930s, Churchill saw the rise of Hitler, of Nazism. He tried to warn his fellow countrymen. They poo-pooed him, but he saw something that other people didn't.
He really did. That's what this book is about, the 1930s and 40s, which have some parallels, unfortunately, to today. In the 1930s, Churchill, a conservative, became alienated from his own conservative party. The conservatives were in power, and their official policy was appeasement of the Nazis. That meant give them little bits and hope they don't come back. And, of course, they did come back again and again. They took a bite of the Rhineland, the land between France and Germany. They took a bite of Czechoslovakia. They took, before that, Austria. And Churchill, throughout the 30s, is standing up and saying in the House of Commons, the fact of the matter is that Germany is rearming. And the Conservative Party didn't want to hear this. And so he is really kept out of government, and he is seen as a kind of aging, washed up, rather pathetic figure through most of the 30s.
In fact, someone's one of his fellow members of the parliament call him unbalanced. I mean, they see him as just sort of he doesn't get it.
He doesn't get it because the smart policy was appeasement. And even now you'll find people who said that, but especially among the aristocrats. Their view was, look, this is the really intelligent, this is the really clever policy because we're not strong enough to fight Germany and nobody else in Europe is going to come along with us. We can't fight them alone. So the smart move is to appease them. And anybody who opposes it is a rather idealistic fool.
You also, this is an important time period for George Orwell as well. He goes to Spain to fight in the Civil War, but comes back really disillusioned with what he saw there.
Orwell, until he went to Spain in 1936, was a fairly conventional 1930s leftist. Left is good, right is bad. In Spain, he was shocked to see that the right lied, but also that the left did. And he was amazed to find that the communist who were part of the Republican government, who were fighting the fascist rebels. The communists were, A, dominated by Soviet officials, that the Soviet espionage agency, the NKVD, was active all across Spain, and that the biggest enemy of the Russians was not the fascist, but the anti-Stalinist left, of which Orwell was associated. And he also gets himself shot through the throat while fighting. He goes back to Spain, he goes back to England after all this, and while recuperating, reads all the newspaper coverage. And what he discovers is what we would call fake news. Everything that was written, he said, was false. Entire battles that had occurred were never covered, and people who had never heard a shot fired were described as heroes. He doesn't become a right-winger as a result of this, but he becomes a dedicated anti-Stalinist socialist. And for the rest of his life, his subject is how to figure out the truth, how to act on your principles, and how to preserve the liberties of the individual from the lies of the left and the right.
Did the left criticize him for criticizing the left?
Yes, and criticism comes in various forms. The Soviets killed some of his friends. He actually feared being killed himself and began carrying a pistol. They also made life difficult for him. His great book, Animal Farm, he had a hard time finding a publisher for, partly because Russian spies working inside the British government, that is to say British citizens who were working for the Russians, put the word out, don't publish this book, and they actually told publishers not to.
Your book also includes a number of speeches that Churchill gave as the war was starting, and I do want to play one of those speeches, and this is Winston Churchill. He's addressing the House of Commons. This is June 18th, 1940, given just over a month after he became prime minister. Let's give it a listen.
The whole fury and might of the enemy must very soon be turned on us. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be free, and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit uplands. But if we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister and perhaps more protracted by the lights of perverted science. Let us, therefore, brace ourselves to our duties and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
And again, Winston Churchill, that inspires still today to hear him say those words.
I find it enormously inspiring and so moving because it feels like Shakespeare speaking to you somehow. You know, what would Shakespeare have sounded like? And this is such an extraordinary moment. This is a real Shakespearean king speaking on the battlefield. Remember, as you said, he has been in office just a few weeks. His political position is very uncertain. A lot of people think he's just an interim guy and that eventually the British will have to make peace with the Germans, settle with the Germans, effectively a surrender, and that obviously he would have to go and probably be imprisoned. France is about to fall at that point. The rest of Europe has already fallen. The Americans are not involved. Mm. England in Europe stands alone. And they are expecting a German landing imminently that summer. And he has such an extraordinary 1940. It is one of the great years that anybody ever had. He's a deeply flawed man, I want to say. He's a fascinating figure because of this. But I do think in those 7 or so months of 1940, he saved the West. And that's quite an accomplishment, especially for someone who was more or less a failure for most of his life.
Which makes, I think, all of us feel much better about our lives, knowing that you can start off kind of on shaky ground and end up sounding like that. Let me segue from that speech to, of course, George Orwell and his 1984, which is about so many different things, including language. War is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength. Obviously, using language to try to expose the kind of totalitarianism that worried him.
Orwell had a bad war. He was in poor health even before he got shot through the throat. His lungs were in very bad shape, yet he still smokes, even as he's coughing up chunks of his lungs.
Ouch.
His lungs started bleeding, actually, at one point in 1938. And he has to go to Morocco to be in a desert climate for a while. Had to borrow the money, basically, to get there. And he watches the war unfold. And by the end of the war, he's deeply concerned about what the future might look like. And in 1984, he kind of lays out, this is what I'm seeing. His hero, by the way, is Winston.
I was going to ask you, Winston Churchill? Stand-in?
There was only one Winston in England in 1948. People referred to politicians by their last names, Chamberlain, Baldwin, Attlee. But Churchill was known as Winston.
Yeah.
There was an intimacy that he had with the public that was really unknown in other politicians and was deeply suspect, by the way, to his aristocratic peers. Winston was seen as a bit of a buccaneer, an American half-breed, they'd like to say. And that was really beyond the pale to be half American and actually to like America. And so Orwell's hero, Winston Smith, has a job. And we tend to remember that one part of the job was to excise uncomfortable facts. When the government decided a fact was no longer true, his job was to literally go and cut it out. And then at the end of his desk, there was the thing called the memory hole,
That's right.
into which he dropped the facts they got rid of. Because the government decided what was true, there was no objective truth. But the other part of his job, as you indicated, was to dumb down language. And so, for example, he's explaining to a friend, we used to have all these difficult words, splendid and excellent. We've gotten rid of them, and now we just have good, and double plus good. And I got to tell you, there's a certain president that reminds me of, who, with this very limited vocabulary, when he goes to a museum of the Holocaust and calls it amazing. Everything is amazing except the countries that are bad. And then there's the people who are very, very bad. And he repeats himself a lot because he doesn't have any other way to say that. He is such a contrast to Churchill in so many ways. Churchill was a real conservative with a dedication to traditions, to personal liberties, and understanding of what this all was about. Churchill had a magnificent vocabulary. His doctor once said that Churchill with words was like an old man with his orchids. He would use six words not to show off, but just because he loved them.
Well, let's take a very short break, and we know what George Orwell thought about fancy words. Talking about Churchill and Orwell, The Fight for Freedom, that's the title of Tom Rick's new book. You can join our conversation. You can text or call our comment line. It's 267-405-2006. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. Much more talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Tom Ricks about his new book, Churchill and Orwell, The Fight for Freedom. He's also an advisor on national security at New America Think Tank. He's a contributing editor to Foreign Policy magazine, covered the U.S. military for many, many years, and has written a number of other books as well. There's been a run on 1984, I think, for obvious reasons. But one of the things that you wrote actually in an article about that is that 1984 describes a world perpetual war, and it certainly feels that way since September 11th, often fought, you know, in faraway lands that people can't necessarily find on a map, fought by people who were specialists in many ways, and probably a lot of the people that you talked about as you covered these wars.
A small number of people on the periphery, not really paid attention to much, and the war, the only reminders of the war are occasional bombs going off in our cities.
Yeah.
What does that remind you of? Yeah.
This is the other 1%, right? The ones who fight our wars?
It is. And boy, have we asked a lot of them. I was once looking at some numbers on World War II, and I think the longest any division was in combat was 12 months total. We've had soldiers who have had 6 or 7 years now through repeated tours of duty in combat zones. it's eerie sometimes how much Orwell anticipated the world we live in. I think the line of 1984 that jumped off the page at me the most was at one point Orwell writes that Winston could not recall a time when his country had not been at war. And right now we have people who are 20 years old who cannot recall a time when this country has not been at war.
How does that change a country? I mean, to be in perpetual war is to sometimes give up your freedoms because there's always that danger of that impending attack, or at least we're told by the government.
I think the epitaph for this whole last couple of decades is something actually an Army colonel said to me in Afghanistan. How can you win a war for your values by undermining them?
What's the answer to that?
Well, I think the implicit answer was you can't.
Yeah.
If in the course of fighting a war, you give up the very liberties that you're trying to protect, you're not doing it the right way.
You think that's what we've done?
I think we panicked after 9/11 as a country, but especially our leadership. I was really in Paris just a couple of weeks ago, and I was really struck. The Parisian attitude towards terror is, yeah, we've had terror a lot. Hey, we invented modern terror during the French Revolution. But as you walk around Paris, you see a lot of sites that have been hit by terror. As a journalist, made a personal pilgrimage to the offices of Charlie Hebdo, the satirical magazine that was shot up. But in the course of it, I walked past a delicatessen that was shot up in 1979 by Abu Nidal, which is a splinter group from El Fatah. And what you notice about the French is they're not waging a war to exterminate terrorism. That would be like their attitude is that's like trying to exterminate bank robbery. We're just trying to contain it and get on with our lives and not let it derange our lives. I worry that we in this country have too much let it derange our lives.
You think that's because of both policies, but also there is a portion of the media that seems to want to scare us.
Yeah, that's called Fox News. And as I told someone the other day, I believe there is a special place in hell for Roger Ailes, Bill O'Reilly, and Sean Hannity. But even more than them, I think that Rupert Murdoch has made billions of dollars selling a product that has really degraded American political discourse. And this yelling at people, this labeling of people, I think we all need to step back, and both the right and the left, and remember that we have actually a definition of who we are. It's called the U.S. Constitution. And the Bill of Rights also tells us how to behave. Freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. These are the core values of the United States as defined by the Founding Fathers. And when people violate those values, they are explicitly acting in an un-American way.
Un-American is a strong word.
Yeah, but when a candidate knocks down a reporter, that, according to the U.S. Constitution, is un-American.
Which happened in Montana.
When a president seems more comfortable with dictators, autocrats, and kings than he is with democratically elected allies, that's un-American. And when that same president seems profoundly ignorant and rather contemptuous of the Constitution, that's un-American. So in a kind of bitter way the other day, I was thinking, where's the committee on House Committee on Un-American Activities when you need them?
Ah, sort of different from the Roy Cohn days, though, right?
Yeah, but I think the liberals and lefts need to stand up for those American values and say, no, you are the people who are acting in an unconstitutional, un-American way. We are about American values. You know, we heard the right talk about values and family for decades, and they finally got their president, who is a serial philanderer, abuser of women, multi-bankrupt businessman, who can't release his tax returns, probably because there's too much financial finagling going on. This is the candidate of the people who've been talking about American values for 20 years? Give me a break. The hypocrisy is staggering.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Tom Ricks, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about a bunch of things, including his new book, Churchill and Orwell, The Fight for Freedom. We're also talking about current day politics and policies. And it's pretty easy to do a couple of segues from these two men to our current times.
Unfortunately,
exactly. A text or call our comment line, 267-405-2006. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Just I'll read a couple of comments here. And then, Tom, I'd love to have you read actually a section from your book that I picked out near the very, very end. One is someone saying, great show. I'm learning a lot. An email from Peter. Did Orwell and Churchill pick and choose their criticisms of those on the left or friends of the left? While they had major concerns with Stalinist thought control on the one hand and Nazism and Stalinism on the other hand, did they really scourge their side to come clean and be honest about who they weren't criticizing?
Yeah, I think they did. Churchill was very clear in the 1930s about who he was criticizing. In fact, he was so angry at one point in the late 30s at the Conservative Party, his own party, he vowed, if they persist in this, I will campaign on every socialist platform available to me in the next election. They steered by their principles. And those core principles were about personal liberty, how to preserve liberty in the era of the intrusive state. And so they're all about freedom of speech, association. People who supported that on the right or the left were their allies. People who opposed that on the right or the left were not. And so I think about this when I see people on the left in this country talk about punching Nazis who are demonstrating in the street. No, in this country, we have to protect speech. And it's easy to protect popular speech. You know, I mean, nobody's going to shut down Jimmy Fallon for making jokes. What you have to do is also be willing to protect repugnant speech, racist speech, Nazi speech. Because first they'll come for the unpopular minority views, and then they're going to shut down other views. You need to protect speech across the board. So what Orwell would say and what I would support him in is anybody who supports liberty is my ally. Anybody who opposes it is not.
Well, and he had all those rules for writing that perhaps, I mean, sort of underscored the importance not just of speech, but of clarity of thought.
Yeah, and this is actually, I think, one of the things that Orwell is not given enough credit for. Orwell developed a vocabulary for thinking about the big state, what he called Big Brother. And a lot of times, what you see is when people are critical of today's surveillance state or of today's surveillance corporation, the Googles and the other Facebooks, the companies that make money off of mining the data of your personal life, he gave us the mindset that enables us to understand that and critique it and see the damage it does.
I'd love to have you read a section from the very end of your book.
Sure. This is the beginning of the afterword in which I try to sum up what Churchill and Orwell mean for us today and what we might take away from them. And I really love this section. It's not the section I enjoyed writing most, which I think that was actually Orwell in Spain. But this section is the most personally significant to me. I think of this as my journalistic last will and testament.
Well, it spoke a lot to me.
When they were confronted by a crucial moment in history, Churchill and Orwell responded first by seeking the facts of the matter. Then they acted on their beliefs. They faced a genuinely apocalyptic situation in which their way of life was threatened with extinction. Many people around them expected evil to triumph and sought to make their peace with it. These two did not. They responded with courage and clear-sightedness. If there is anything we can take away from them, it is the wisdom of employing this two-step process, especially in times of mind-bending crisis. Work diligently to discern the facts of the matter, and then use your principles to respond. They also often were wrong in their judgments, but they were determined to keep trying to get to the root of the matter, which is equally important. Orwell especially never stopped trying to see clearly through all the lies, obfuscations, and distractions. Instead of shaping facts to fit his opinions, he was willing to let facts change his opinions. as we deal with terrorism, global warming, domestic inequality, and racism, and also with panicky politicians and demagogic leaders. We would do well to remember how these two men reacted to the overwhelming events of their own time. They were especially good at recognizing the delusions of their own social sets. Always a useful tool, if not a good way to make and keep friends.
That's Tom Ricks reading from the afterword of his book. And I circled and scribbled all over that section because I just felt it was a wonderful kind of segue from these two men to our times, which got me thinking, who's the Winston Churchill of today? Who's the George Orwell of today that you see?
When I look at American life and history, the first person who leapt to mind in considering this was Martin Luther King. And that's why in the afterword I go directly to his letter for the Birmingham jail, which is very much like Orwell's writing. What are the facts of the matter, he writes. He scribbles in a newspaper in his jail cell because they won't give him writing paper. The fact of the matter is, he says, that Birmingham is the most segregated city in America. The fact of the matter is that the Negro in Birmingham is subjected to police violence to keep him from exercising his civil liberties. And this is, it's an essay that I think both Churchill and Orwell would love, and I love. In our own time, we haven't seen people respond to the current crisis. I think we probably will eventually. What I'm looking for is people who act on principle. And secondarily, people willing to criticize their own party allies when those principles are violated. I keep on expecting John McCain to step up, but I think he's getting a little bit old and tired.
He goes so far, it seems.
Yeah, and then pulls back. I've been surprised that one of my own senators, I live in Maine, Susan Collins, a centrist Republican, has been rather quiet about this, and I don't know why. The people who especially interest me these days, and this is kind of surprising to me, are conservatives who, as a matter of principle, refuse to get on the Trump train. And I'm paying a lot of attention to these. Right now, it's basically journalists and academics. Elliot Cohen of Johns Hopkins is one. He also writes for The Atlantic. Charles Krauthammer, longtime conservative columnist. Jennifer Rubin, a younger conservative columnist. George Will on occasion. But these conservatives, Michael Gerson is another one, former Bush speechwriter, who is very strong in talking about principle and why Trump is not a conservative. These people have insights that I don't have because I'm not a conservative and I don't know that world as well. But I find myself paying special attention to them. They have real insights to offer, and they're in such an uncomfortable and unexpected position. Mm. Here they are, conservatives, who are really now more allied with Bernie Sanders than they are with a Republican president.
This is the world that we live in.
It's a very unsettled and tumultuous world. And it's every morning you go, you know, okay, what happened in the last 12 hours?
Is that a good question to ask? I mean, I think many of us are asking it, waking up in the morning, say, uh-oh, you know, what are we going to deal with today?
I think it is. That said, we have a president who tweets and who fulminates, but I don't think he really is a president. I think he plays one on TV. And I've increasingly come to feel that we really have a decapitated government. And it's kind of nice to see, actually, that the U.S. government is actually pretty robust. It chugs along. There's really no one running the government. There's no one really at the White House having an effect. But the Defense Department does this thing. State rolls along. Yes, Immigration, Customs, and Border Patrol seem a little bit out of control to me. And that worries me. But across the board, generally, the U.S. government is just doing its own thing. And so increasingly, I've come to think that the saving grace of Donald Trump is his incompetence. And it scares me to think, what if we had a competent Donald Trump, a guy who was effective and interested in government and knew how to drive an agenda through Congress? Instead, we have a guy who fails to get anything through Congress, gets slapped down by the judiciary, and alienates our longtime allies while sucking up to dictators. This is the version of The Godfather in which Fredo becomes Godfather, not Michael Corleone. And with the mafia family, I'd like to see incompetent mafia families. Likewise, I have come to applaud the incompetence of Donald Trump.
Are you surprised that you have come to that opinion?
I am. Early on, I had several old friends in national security. I've known these people for decades. I've known H.R. McMaster really since he was a major in the Army 25 years ago. And sometimes people would say to me, Tom, you know, what do you think if I go into the government? Would you do it? And I said, not on the domestic side, but national security, yes. We need to protect this country. And we all know people in uniform. They can't just take off their uniform because Donald Trump is president. So, yes, we need a few adults in the room. But lately, and especially watching H.R. McMaster, I've come to think, no, do not go into this government in any capacity. Let 1,000 Trumpian failures bloom. Don't put lipstick on this pig. Let's get the full reactionary incompetent Trump. Don't enable him. Don't make him mildly competent. Let Bannon rule. And let's see how America does. Because it won't do well. And I think the Republicans are going to get creamed if they don't separate themselves from this president.
I want to pick up on several things you just said there, Tom Ricks. Tom Ricks, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, won a Pulitzer Prize in his career as a journalist. His new book is Churchill and Orwell, The Fight for Freedom. And we've got a lot of comments here. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Text or call our comment line, 267-405-2006. We have a couple of McMaster clips that we've got lined up as well, so we'll pick up on what was just said. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Tom Ricks. He mentioned Tom Ricks right before the break. Actually, he mentioned H.R. McMaster, someone that you knew, Tom, from your days of as a war correspondent, I guess, from his experience out in warfare. He's now, of course, a national security advisor. And this is something he said. This was May 15th. Almost feels like ancient history, but he was responding to a Washington Post story, in fact, kind of debunking the story that President Trump revealed classified information to the Russian foreign minister and to the ambassador during an Oval Office meeting. Let's give that a listen.
The story that came out tonight, as reported, is false. The president and the foreign minister reviewed a range of common threats to our two countries, including threats to civil aviation. At no time, were intelligence sources or methods discussed. And the president did not disclose any military operations that were not already publicly known. Two other senior officials who were present, including the Secretary of State, remember the meeting the same way and have said so. Their on-the-record accounts should outweigh those of anonymous sources. And I was in the room. It didn't happen.
Apparently that didn't happen either. This is H.R. McMaster the next day at a press briefing on May 16th, also addressing a Washington Post report that Trump shared sensitive intelligence with Russian diplomats.
That conversation was wholly appropriate to the conversation, and I think wholly appropriate what the expectations are of our intelligence partners.
And Tommy said wholly appropriate, I think, four or five, six, seven times during that interchange with that reporter. And I have to say, I thought of George Orwell when I heard that.
Yeah, wholly appropriate is one of those Washington weasel phrases. It made me very sad to see H.R. McMaster during those couple of days. I've known him since he was a professor of history at West Point. He's a general. He's a smart general. He's not just any smart general. He literally wrote the book on the failures of our generals during the Vietnam War, his book called Dereliction of Duty, yeah, which originally was his PhD dissertation at the University of North Carolina, one of the 10 best books on the Vietnam War. To see H.R. McMaster come out and use those weasel words and phrases, the first time he says the story is false, the next morning he comes out and he says the premise of the story was false. Well, when I've been around the block as a reporter a few decades, and when somebody says your premise is false, that means they can't argue with the facts, but they don't like the story. it made me sad to see McMaster do this. His job is to protect the country, not to protect the president as national security advisor. And he's also still on active duty. As a general on active duty, he remains subject to military law, the U.S. Uniform Code of Military Justice, which holds officers to a very high standard. The standards are such that if, for example, President Trump were subject to the UCMJ, he likely would have been charged with several offenses, such as sexual harassment and making false statements. But in our system, politicians are not subject to the UCMJ. But McMaster is, and so McMaster needs to be judged somewhat differently. I think when he came out and was misleading, frankly, to defend the president, he must have given up a little bit of his soul to do that. He knows what he's doing. He's a very emotional guy. I've actually heard that tone of voice in him before, was his voice kind of thickens and speeds up. I've seen him speaking, kind of roll his shoulders as he's trying to loosen his back muscles. He's not like another general, David Petraeus, who really has a hard shellac shell to him. McMaster is a very emotional, I would say, even soulful man. So he must know what he's been doing and must understand the personal cost of this and the crushing pressures he's under. So the question has to be, why is he doing it?
Right. And why, and will he stay? I mean, that's always a question.
I suspect he's doing it because he is one of the adults in the room, and he worries that if he stepped down, he would be replaced by another guy like General Flynn, or even worse, some ideological ally of Bannon. And so he says, no, I have to make these personal sacrifices as part of my duty to my country. I think that's the wrong calculation. I think that he has a real duty to his country, so I can't see him lasting more than a few more months in this job.
Do you think he knows your opinion about that? You're obviously very public about it.
He's a very busy man. I'm not sure he has time to pay attention to what I'm saying, but I kind of suspect he does.
There are several generals. There's Mattis. There's Kelly, Homeland Security. And they all have these amazing backgrounds and experiences. Is there a place for that level of military in our government?
I worry about having too many generals in our government, but I'm willing to make an exception here because these are mature, thoughtful, seasoned people, which is a real contrast to the other people that Trump has brought into the White House and other senior positions. I think Mattis has done a very good job as Secretary of Defense. What you're getting is a somewhat more aggressive version of Obama's Middle Eastern policies and other policies. Mattis was retired early by the Obama administration when he was chief of the Central Command, precisely because he wanted to be more aggressive in dealing with Iran, and was kind of seen as biting at the bit to do that. That said, the generals have been rather diverse in their performance. Mattis has done well. John Kelly as Secretary of Homeland Security, I think not so well. I'm a bit worried about him. And obviously, Flynn blew up on the launch pad.
Yeah. Let me play Jeff. And Jeff called into our comment line. This is Jeff calling into Radio Times.
Jeff from Hocasin. My question for your guest is, what does he think about Barack Obama violating the Fourth Amendment and using the FISA court to spy on Americans?
Well, there were a New York Times reporter. In fact, we talked about this on Radio Times when all this was going on, that President Barack Obama was very critical of the press, and even more. I mean, everyone that gets covered by the press feels that way, but went after some reporters.
This is a long-term trend, and you're right. It didn't begin with Trump, nor did it begin with Obama. I think it is getting worse. I think we all have to go back to first principles of this country. And you indicate something that I've really been stewing about lately. I think in many ways the biggest problem in this country is the Democratic Party. It needs to get back to first principles. Not everybody who voted for Trump is a racist jerk. A lot of people feel alienated by the Democratic Party out there. The Democratic Party seems to have lost its ability to talk to a big chunk of the country. There was a feeling, I think, among a lot of people that no matter whether Trump won or Hillary Clinton won, Goldman Sachs would win, Wall Street would win. As Bernie Sanders said, and I was not a big Sanders fan, but I think he was right on this, right now we have a situation in which Congress doesn't regulate Wall Street. Wall Street regulates Congress.
Yeah.
That goes to campaign finance. I think the Democratic Party has sold out to campaign finance because it needed money. The problem with that is it makes the Democratic Party, A, unable to do what it needs to do in the Congress, and B, not really responsive to the people it needs to speak to. I mean, no matter what happened with Trump and the Russians, the fact of the matter is Hillary Clinton ran a lousy campaign and failed to speak to places she should have spoken to, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania.
Let me read an email from Stu. Because our attention is glued to Trump, the GOP appointees in Congress get to do their work largely out of view. They know Trump will sign anything Congress puts on their desk. Do you think that's true? And you talked about the fact that you feel as if the system is holding. We have branches of government, and they are doing, at least one branch, from your perspective, is doing its job.
Yeah, the founding fathers, in their wisdom, devised a system that actually did anticipate this situation. The Constitution was written very much in reaction to how the British handled the situation leading up to the American Revolution and also to the English Civil War a century earlier. And what they wanted was a military that was restrained and independent chunks of the government that could hold each other in check. That's what we call it, checks and balances. And a check is like a hockey check. It can be rather powerful. And this is what Trump is running into, which is the judiciary slaps him down. Congress doesn't pass anything he sends over there. I mean, or expect it to become law. You get this big show about health care, but nobody expects Trump care as it's being offered to go through. He's really gotten almost nothing else through Congress. So, yeah, the irony here is the system is working.
What do you make of all the leaks? And they're coming from the White House. They're coming from the intelligence community. They're coming from all over the government, the defense.
When I was a reporter for 20 years in Washington, most of the leaks I got were what I thought of as institutional leaks. They weren't out of personal vendettas or beliefs. It's when a Navy captain running a submarine acquisition program is getting in a fight with a congressman over, and he asked me to come over into his office, and he says, look, Tom, the congressman represents the competing contractor. Of course he's upset with me, but I've got to make a decision here, and I think, you know, I went with this contractor for these reasons because of this performance and this cost. And the only time I really began to see a lot of what I would call personal leaks was when Donald Rumsfeld became Secretary of Defense. He so antagonized senior officers in the Pentagon. They felt disrespected. They don't mind strong, intense, and even decisive leadership that goes against them. They all loved Robert Gates as Secretary of Defense.
For that reason? Those reasons?
Yeah. Gates fired people left and right. Rumsfeld just let them hang there, twisting in the wind and tormenting and mocking them, and they hated that. I remember once I got a call from a general kind of laughing at me about 4 in the afternoon. He said, Tom, you won't believe what Rumsfeld just said in the tank, which is where the Joint Chiefs meet. He said, okay, that's decided, and I don't want to read about this in the Washington Post tomorrow morning. And of course, I wrote
about it. There you go. Right.
So I think we're seeing a lot of those sort of personal leaks right now. But the leakiest place in Washington is the Trump White House. And also intelligence people who have intelligence that Trump denies and says is lies. And they say, we actually have these facts. Yeah. We know that false statements were made. We know that certain people lied to investigators. People say, this is all smoke and no fire. Why has President Trump had a pattern here of trying to shut down the investigation? Why did he fire first the acting attorney general, then the FBI director, and ask the heads of the intelligence agencies to kind of wave off on this investigation? I think Trump is running scared. Why? Because I think there is fire there.
Hmm.
I think at core, this is probably not stuff like Flynn. Flynn's a minor figure in the periphery, kind of a chump who came late to the game. I think the core of this is probably that in the 1990s, President Trump had gone through a couple of bankruptcies in his businesses. He couldn't get loans from American bankers. He could get loans from Russians. And I think ultimately he couldn't repay some of those loans. Well, when a big loan is forgiven, and these I think were multi-million, you need to report that on your tax returns as a gift. And either he did report that, and it looks like, well, this guy got millions of dollars free from the Russians, or he didn't report it and he's got some legal problems.
Mm.
So there's no good outcome for him here except to squelch the investigations as best he can.
Let me go back to something you said about the French and how the French handle terrorism. This is an email from Helena who says, if the French are handling terrorism so well, why are they talking about banning the hijab, the burkini? I mean, in certain ways, I think the U.S. has been a more welcoming country. You can wear, you can be covered in this country and no one's gonna say anything about it or worry about it.
Yes, and I think the French need to take a different course on this. The French have a different self-conception, a different sense of their culture, their role in the world. And the French also have a much larger migrant population than we do. That said, I think there is a war going on in France between its inside its Muslim population. It's especially a generational war. There's an older generation that didn't participate in French politics, often didn't speak French, and felt outside French culture. There's a younger generation that was born in France, raised there, speaks French, and is participating in politics. And I think what you're seeing in France right now is very much a struggle over what does it mean to be Muslim in France. And I think the French understand that. But my larger point was the French are pretty low-key about this. You don't see Rambo-ized police officers in the streets looking like paramilitary special operators or something. What I noticed when I was on vacation in France, and you've got to be an old war correspondent to do this, I would sort of watch the security guys. They operate in teams of three. We were right on the edge of the old Jewish neighborhood in Le Marais, so they were very worried about it. But low-key, teams of three, often one of the three would be a woman, sometimes wearing a scarf, a police officer, or somebody who looked Algerian in some way. Not really dressed up like Rambo. The only real exceptions was usually one of the three would have an automatic weapon, and they all wore knee pads. And I asked why, and the security expert told me, that's so you can throw yourself to the ground quickly because people tend to go down slowly because they're afraid of hurting their knees. You need to go down faster than gravity if they're shooting or a bomb.
Well, on that note, we have to end our conversation. Tom Ricks, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
You're welcome.
The book is called Churchill and Orwell, The Fight for Freedom. Tom Ricks, a longtime military correspondent, covered a number of operations around the world. And he's an advisor on national security at the New America think tank. He's a contributing editor to Foreign Policy magazine. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowing. Thank you so much for joining us.